Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for attending today's second installment of the University of Regina's Library Beyond the Book Lecture Series. My name is Michael Shires. I'm the Collection Development Librarian. And today's session is titled An Introduction to French Science Fiction. It's sponsored by the library and the Institut Français. The lecturers today will serve as a lead-in to a multidisciplinary conference on French science fiction called Pain dans l'œil de la lune, or Pau in the Eye of the Moon. This conference will be held on November 2nd, 3rd at the U of R's main campus. Today's session will have three faculty from the University of Regina speak on different aspects of French science fiction. Each presentation will be about 15 minutes, and at the very end, there'll be a question and answer session, and then there'll be refreshments afterwards. So our first speaker today is Dr. Nicholas Ruddick. He is a professor and head of the English department at the University of Regina. He's taught here since 1982. He regularly teaches courses on science fiction, horror fiction, and fairy tales. He's the author or editor of 9 books and many articles on literary subjects from Atwood to Zola. His most recent book is called The Fire in the Stone, Prehistoric Fiction from Charles Darwin to Jean M. Aou. Probably mispronounced that. Apologies. From 2009. It surveys fiction about cavemen and women in both the Anglophone and Francophone traditions. Dr. Ruddick will discuss French science fiction in literature. So please welcome Dr. Nicholas Ruddick.
Thanks very much, Michael, and thank you all for coming. The French relationship to science fiction has been described by the Science Fiction Encyclopedia as, quote, a long flirtation marked by episodic outbursts of passion. And I will be dealing here with the episodic outbursts of passion insofar as it's a bit of a tall order to cover the whole of French science fiction in 15 minutes. But we'll begin with a couple of significant ancestors. The first would be Cyrano de Bergerac. He's the sword fighter with the big nose, famous from the play by Edmond Rostand. But Cyrano was a real person. He was a free-thinking, satirical author, and he was the first French science fiction writer. He wrote L'autre monde, ou Les états empire de la lune, The Other World, or The States and Empires of the Moon, which was published posthumously in 1657. And there's also a sequel, The States and Empires of the Sun, which was published a couple of years after that. In it, Cyrano himself travels to the moon using rockets powered by firecrackers, and there he meets the inhabitants, the moon men, who have 4 legs, musical voices, and firearms that not only shoot game, but cook it as well. After Cyrano, quite a while after Cyrano, we have Voltaire, the great philosopher and wit of the Enlightenment. In 1752, Voltaire published a story called Micromégas, which describes a visit to the Earth by 2 giants from outer space. The bigger of the two, Micromégas himself, from the star Sirius, is 20,000 feet tall. And when he stands in the deepest part of the ocean, he barely wets his legs. So he's looking around, trying to find any signs of living creatures on the Earth, and he sees this tiny little speck swimming around. It's a whale. Next to the whale, there is a boatload of philosophers, but he doesn't see those to begin with. He assumes that whatever it is must be too small to be of any significance at all. But eventually, the philosophers make their presence felt to the giant, and the 2 giants burst out laughing when they hear that the philosophers describe St. Thomas Aquinas's belief that the universe is made for the human species. Thirdly, and rather unexpectedly, we have the great French novelist Honoré de Balzac. In 1822, under a pseudonym, Balzac published a novel called Le Centenaire ou les Deux Beringeld. This has been recently translated as The Centenarian by Daniel Châtelain and George Slosser. It's about a scientist who gains longevity by absorbing the life force of others. And Châtelain and Slosser, the editors, call it the prototype of French science fiction, even though they are aware that very, very few people read this book, and even fewer were actually influenced by it. But they see in it the French Cartesian obsession with the rational mind that is hyper-aware of the problem of the body. And they believe that this Cartesian theme has written the central tradition of French science fiction. And it continues to recur in recent well-regarded novels by such writers as Philippe Curval, Kurt Steiner, and Michel Jury. The equivalent in Anglophone science fiction might well be Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which deals with the different but very central subject in Anglophone science fiction of the dangers of artificial creation. Just a footnote, but very recently it was discovered that Félix Baudin, a critic, wrote in 1834 Le Roman de l'Avenir, the novel of the future. And this was not a work of fiction, but actually the first critical work that lays out the aesthetic of futuristic fiction, or science fiction itself. Now we come to the granddaddy of French science fiction, and indeed science fiction in general. Jules Verne, 1828 to 1905, born in Nantes, but resident in Amiens most of his life. With H.G. Wells, Jules Verne was one of the two founding fathers of modern science fiction. He wrote 67 books, making up the Voyage Extraordinaire. These were intended, these books, chiefly for young people, actually, to be specific, for boys. Verne didn't really do girls or women in any sense of the word. And the aim of the books was to inspire these young people with technological possibilities and enable France thereby to shake off its cultural dégénérescence, I like that word, it's got four acute accents in it, and catch up with England and the United States. Verne began his close relationship with his publisher, Pierre Jules Hetzel, in 1863, publishing in that year his first extraordinary voyage, Cinq Semaines en Ballon, 5 weeks in a balloon. And then followed the masterpieces that everyone's heard of, Voyage au centre de la Terre, Journey to the Centre of the Earth, published in 1864, De la Terre à la Lune, From the Earth to the Moon in 1865, 20 000 lieues sous les mers, 20,000 leagues under the sea in 1869, and Le Tour du Monde en 80 jours, Around the World in 80 Days, published in 1873. Jules Verne wrote about two books a year, which were soon immediately translated into English and many other languages. He himself was a pious Catholic who rejected Darwinian evolution. He stuck strictly to what was known about the present world and for the most part avoided the future. So in the Journey to the Center of the Earth, the explorers find mammoths in the subterranean world. And this proves that they haven't really gone extinct because God would not allow extinction. The mammoths, in fact, had just become victims of a landslip. They'd been living on the surface of the earth. They fell beneath the earth, and there they continue to live happily. Nevertheless, the influence of Jules Verne on science fiction was immense, and Hugo Gernsback, the editor of the first American science fiction magazine, Amazing Stories, that came out in April of 1926, had the image of Jules Verne's tomb inscribed over his editorial page, and he serialized Verne's novel Hector Servadac as Off on a Comet in the first issue of Amazing Stories. Next comes Camille Flammarion, the astronomer, who wrote an epic of the future called La Fin du Monde, The End of the World, in 1893. And it's a novel in a very, very similar vein to H.G. Wells' The Time Machine, which appeared 2 years later. Flammarion wrote, "This end of the world will occur without noise, without revolution, without cataclysm. Just as a tree loses its leaves in the autumn wind, so the earth will see in succession the falling and perishing of all its children. And in this eternal winter, which will envelop it from then on, she can no longer hope for either a new sun or a new spring." And actually, this novel was adapted to film by Abel Gance in the 1930s. The most important French science fiction writer after Jules Verne, who was known as J.H. Rosny, but actually Rosny was a nom de plume of two brothers who were born in Brussels. The older, Rosny Aîné, whose real name was Joseph Henri Honoré Boëx, his dates are 1856 to 1940, was responsible for Rosny's best work, including the short story Les Zippeus, published in 1887, and this is the very first important alien invasion story in science fiction that's based on scientific principles. Primitive humans encounter inorganic aliens with whom all forms of communication prove impossible. It's a story very far ahead of its time. Rosny's best-known novel is also set in the prehistoric past. It is La Guerre du Feu, 1911, known in English as Quest for Fire, and memorably filmed by Jean-Jacques Annaud in 1981. Rosny produced half a dozen other works set in prehistory, as well as many more conventional futuristic science fiction novels. Le roman préhistorique, the prehistoric novel, is a sister genre to science fiction that has a longer and more distinguished tradition in French than it does in English. As I explain in my book, The Fire and the Stone, many early prehistoric artifacts were found in France so that the French had an intense curiosity about what their ancestors were like when mammoths drank from the River Seine or from the Vézère. Unlike Jules Verne, these writers accepted the Darwinian view that human beings had evolved, rather than the biblical view that they had been created from scratch in 4004 BC. So the first prehistoric fiction was Paris avant les hommes, in 1861, Paris before man, and it was published only 2 years after Darwin's Origin of Species. This book was also an attack on Georges Cuvier, the great French naturalist, who had denied that fossil men existed. An excellent contemporary French writer of prehistoric fiction is Pierre Pelot, author of Le Rêve de Lucie, published in 1990. It's so far untranslated. Lucie's Dream would be the translation of the title. And this Lucie is the original of the famous fossil Australopithecus afarensis found in Africa. Pelot is also the author of several other novels in the Sous le Vent du Monde series. As in English science fiction, with writers like E.M. Forster, Doris Lessing, and Margaret Atwood, so in French, where certain well-regarded mainstream writers have occasionally strayed into science fiction. The late 19th century symbolist writer Villiers de l'Isle-Adam published in 1886 his novel L'Ève Future, translated as Tomorrow's Eve into English, in which the great American inventor Thomas Edison is called upon to construct a female android who will be far superior in beauty and sophistication to the hero's real-life fiancé. This is not a feminist classic, this work. Then Anatole France, the Nobel Prize-winning novelist and poet, published the satirical fantasy L'Île des Pingouins, Penguin Island, in 1908. In it, a colony of penguins is mistakenly baptized by a missionary, forcing God to turn them all into human beings. At which point they then recapitulate human history with all its follies, including the Penguin Dreyfus affair, culminating in a futuristic penguin society which is totally destroyed by terrorist bombs. Then Vercors, who was a pseudonym of the novelist Jean Brulaire, published Les Animaux Dénaturés in 1952. It's been translated in a number of ways, usually as Borderline, and it was filmed with Burt Reynolds as Skullduggery in 1970. In it, a whole new species of hominid missing links, the tropies, is discovered alive in the modern world. Capitalists want to exploit them as slaves, so to save them, the hero is forced to kill an infant that he himself fathered upon a tropy female. Then he turns himself in. If he can persuade the court that his act was murder, this would prove that tropies are human and thus save them from slavery as subhumans. Very interesting philosophical novel. Now, more recent French science fiction writers. I've mentioned some already. There are too many to enumerate. But of those translated into English, I'll mention Nathalie Henneberg, whose dates are 1917 to 77, whose novel Les Dieux Verts was translated by C.J. Cherry as The Green Gods in 1980. There is Gérard Klein, born in 1937, whose Les Seigneurs de la Guerre, published in 1971, was translated by John Brunner as The Overlords of War. And there is Stéphane Voule, 1922 to 2003, whose 1957 novel Hommes en série was adapted into the animated classic film La Planète Sauvage, Fantastic Planet, 1973. And this was finally translated into English in 2010, just a couple of years ago, this novel. Finally, the upcoming conference's very distinguished keynote speaker, Elisabeth Vonaborg, born in 1947 in Paris, but resident in Quebec since 1973. Her first novel, Le Silence de la Cité, published in 1981, was translated as The Silent City in 1986. It received the Prix Rosny-Aîné, which is the main prize of French science fiction, in 1982. Elisabeth has a PhD in creative writing, 1987. She was literary editor of the science fiction and fantasy Quebecois magazine Solaris from 1979 to 1990. And she organized the first Quebecois science fiction convention in 1979. Another of her many science fiction novels, Chronique du Pays des Mers, was published simultaneously in French and in English by Bantam in the United States in 1992 as In the Mother's Land and as The Mareland Chronicles in Canada in 1993. This novel received the 1993 Philip K. Dick Special Award and was a finalist of the James Tiptree Award for science fiction written by women. It also won the 1993 Boreal, Aurora, and Grand Prix Logidec Awards. So I hope everybody will come and see Elisabeth when she's here next week. Thank you very much.
Much. Our second speaker is Dr. Sauvé Rion. He is an associate professor at the University of Regina in the Department of French and has been teaching since 1998. With Bernard Dupuis, he is co-author of The Clé de Précide, an interactive dictionary of literary devices, which is available online. Francophone comics are part of Dr. Rion's childhood. American comics entertained his teen years, and he went to Japan to read mangas as a young adult. Dr. Rion's other fields of interest are 20th century French literature, rhetoric, and stylistics. He will discuss French science fiction in comic book form. So please welcome Dr. Sauvé Rion.
So my presentation is about French science fiction, bande dessinée, and I will refer to French comics as bande dessinée in my presentation. My presentation will take the form of a show and tell, and that's why I brought all those comics with me. And the audience will have a chance to browse through the albums as I will be talking about them. I will do first a brief survey of comics before 1945, just to give you a kind of a broad picture of what we're talking about. And after that, I will focus mostly on albums published after the Second World War. Many albums will be presented, and three of them will be highlighted as being particularly significant works. Before 1945, some French scholars established the beginning of graphic storytelling in France as early as cave paintings, but I think this is an exaggeration. There was, however, the Image d'Épinal, born in the 15th century and associated with the village of Épinal, where many of those were printed. So this is what Image d'Épinal would like. It would be, sizes will vary, but it would be maybe a bigger kind of poster size. And in the 15th century, like people who couldn't read would buy Image d'Épinal and kind of retell the stories by looking at the pictures. Then, in 1827, Rodolphe Topfer, a teacher from Switzerland, publishes some of the stories and images he created for his students. The stories are dynamic and very bold in design. He is recognized both by the Americans and the Europeans as the inventor of the medium of comics. But with print runs of about 500 copies, his creations were not widely distributed, and very few people read his stories. Although Goethe was very impressed by the novelty of Topfer's work. And this is an excerpt from one of his creation. So after the presentation, like, you are welcome to come and take a look at the books and the illustrations. In 1895, Richard Felton Outco creates The Yellow Kid, the first comic strip for Joseph Pulitzer's New York World. No, I'm just traveling to the United States for a little while. And later, some of these strips will be collected into books. Hence, the comic books was born. So first, the comic books in North America were a collection of strips. So you would put three strips together, and that would be the format of your page. Eventually, a publisher had the idea of creating stories directly into the comic book format. Now, I'm giving you these facts in order to establish some comparison between the American and Franco-Belgian publishers. The American comic book has deep roots in popular culture. This means cheap paper, soft cover, low page count, and black and white interior, or later, rough four colors. Back in Europe, in 1929, Hergé, creator of Tintin, introduced his famous character in the children's supplement of the 20th siècle, a conservative Belgian newspaper. Later, Tintin Adventures will be reprinted in albums by publisher Glénat, and then from 1942, Tintin stories were published in a nice hardcover album and were delicately colored inside. Compared to the American comic books, the album is obviously meant to be collected, not thrown away after consumption. Because of the high quality of the container, artists will be expected to produce high-quality content. An American artist will produce one page per day, while his or her American counterpart will produce only one page per week. So this gives you kind of the level of work that is put into a French page of comic. In 1934, the Journal de Mickey, a magazine intended for young readers, is launched, featuring mostly translated American comics. In the economic context of the day, it was much cheaper to translate available American series than to hire a local artist to create brand new ones. The situation is similar today in France, where Japanese mangas are translated by hundreds every year. But let's go back in the 30s, and soon rival magazines will follow the Journal de Mickey and flooded the market with magazines full of American content. French public is then exposed to American sci-fi series like Buck Rogers by Dick Calkins and Phil Nolan, as well as Flash Gordon, translated as Guy Leclerc in French, by Alex Raymond, which will have tremendous influence on future creators. During the German occupation of France, from 1940 to 44, Americans' comics could not be imported anymore. French artists were asked to create series to satisfy the demand. Edgar P. Jacob, for example, continued the series Flash Gordon that was suddenly interrupted during the German occupation. So it means that Flash Gordon has two endings, one made by the American original artist, another one made by the French artist who continued the series. Later in 1943, Jacob created Le Rayon U, a story similar in many aspects to Flash Gordon. Then in 1945, right after the war, Roger Lécureux and Raymond Poivet created Les Pionniers de l'Espérance. And here the library has a copy. It is clearly inspired by the style of the American series like Flash Gordon. The characters were multinational. There was Tanga from France, Maud, an American, Tsinlu, a Chinese, and Rodzian, a Soviet. The series was published in the magazine Vaillant, later known as Pif Gadget, until 1973. Vaillant was linked to the Communist Party in France. Poivet was very influential on many future creators, including Uderzo, who would do Asterix, and Drouillet, who would be one of the founders of Metal Hurlant, that I'm going to be talking about a little later. In the years following the war, many new magazines were launched, including Tintin. Here I'm referring to the magazine Tintin, not the series Tintin, which is something different, and Pilote. Some would offer American comics, some others would hire local artists. However, American comics published before the establishment of the Comics Code Authority in 1945, so those comics preceding 1945, were sometimes particularly violent. As a result, partly under the pressure of parents, partly under the pressure of those publishers who wanted to lessen the importance of American comics, in 1949, the government of France passed a new law intended to protect youth from violent comics. This law is called Loi pour la jeunesse du 16 juillet 1949. And if you look in like older editions of Tintin, you will see the law that the law is respected by this particular comic. In 1946, Edgar P. Jacobs, already known as the continuator of Flash Gordon and a close collaborator of Hergé, created his famous series, Blake et Mortimer. Here it is. Featuring two British men, Sir Francis Blake, officer in the Royal Air Force, and Professor Philip Mortimer, a physicist. Mixing a darker tone with science fiction themes like time travel, robots, ultimate weapons, the series was very popular, partly because it was seen as a continuation of the beloved American science fiction series of the 30s, but now done in a more European style, using the ligne claire, it's the how you describe the style of Hergé, the ligne claire popularized by Hergé. Blake et Mortimer is still continued today by various artists. In 1953, Hergé publishes Objectif Lune, followed the next year by On a marché sur la lune. Hergé, the most famous Franco-Belgian author, needs a little introduction. Despite the fact that Tintin's contribution to the science fiction genre includes only a voyage to the moon and an encounter with extraterrestrials in 1968, in Vol 714 pour Sydney, Hergé is important to mention because of the influence of his style. Lots of research were done for each album. Visual references were used. A whole team of collaborators would participate in the creation of a story. So standards were set very high for creators in the Franco-Belgian industry. In 1953, writer Henri Verne, who pretends to have some link to Jules Verne, but actually it has never been proven, creates the character Bob Morhal, who will be adapted in bande dessinée from 1959. Bob Morhal could be compared to the Pulp Fiction character Doc Savage, and many of his adventures involve time traveling and fighting evil geniuses. New albums are still published today, even after more than 50 years. Now it's Barbarella, one of the iconic bande dessinée of science fiction. In 1962, Jean-Claude Forêt publishes Barbarella, a female traveler exploring a science fiction universe who sleeps with one man, then goes to another, just like a typical macho character would do. By today's standard, Barbarella would seem tame, but in the context of the law of 1949, it was nothing less than a revolution, and the story caused a scandal at the time. In the 60s, the mood was favorable for social changes, including sexual revolution. Barbarella definitely established an adult genre for bande dessinée. From now on, there will be albums for kids and albums for adults. Artists could now target a more mature audience, ready to tackle more mature subjects. The movie adaptation of Barbarella made Jane Fonda famous. And thanks to Barbarella's daring stance, the door was now open for the creation of new series, and many of them would become very popular. In 1966, Philippe Drouillet publishes Lone Sloan. Drouillet is famous for his huge panels. I'm going to just to show you. So he's not like, his comic book is not like a series of panels, but like he uses the whole panel. And sometimes he uses like the double page as one big image, like this one here. So Drouillet is famous for his huge panels full of very small details featuring strange statues of ancient gods, floating stones, etc. The style of his illustrations evokes the album covers of rock bands. Just like rock music, there is a tone of contestation and innovation in Drouillet's work. Drouillet will later become one of the founders of Metal Hurlant. Then in 1967, Pierre Christin and Jean-Claude Mézières created Valérian et Laureline. Mézières spent some time in the United States where he worked as a cowboy. Valérian and Laureline worked together for the Space-Time Agency. Couples are quite rare in bande dessinée, and this is what makes this series unique, along with the mystery of extraterrestrial and the myriads of strange worlds. It is worth mentioning that Mézières collaborated to the movie The Fifth Element, directed by Luc Besson. The flying yellow taxis, as well as many landscapes, are his invention. And also, many fans of this series believe that Star Wars stole many ideas from Valérian et Laureline. But maybe Philippe will say a few words about that. In 1969, Roger Leloup created Yoko Tsuno, a female Japanese electronic engineer. She will travel to distant corners of the galaxy, encountering humanoid aliens and flying fancy spaceships. Leloup started his career as a BDist at Studio Hergé, where he was in charge of drawing aircrafts and cars in the albums of Tintin. This series is intended for children and might not be as famous as those intended for adults. But the vehicles imagined by Leloup are nothing short of spectacular. Metal Hurlant, created by Moebius Philippe Drouillet and Jean-Pierre Dionnet in January of 1955, Metal Hurlant was the first magazine to be totally devoted to science fiction. It soon attracted talents from all over Europe. 2 years later, in 1977, an American version known as Heavy Metal was launched. Here I don't have the French version, so this is the American version. And it doesn't mean that they would use exactly the same content as the French version, because the two editorial staff are different and they work separately. At first, the magazine, the English version was just an English version of the French magazine. But for the time it lasted, so Metal Hurlant was launched in 75 and lasted until 1987. Then they started to launch it again in 2002, but it flopped after 2 years. Metal Hurlant provided science fiction bande dessinée in France with an incredible momentum. Jean Giraud, who used the pseudonym Moebius when he's working on a science fiction project, used his real name when he's working on other series. Sadly, Moebius just passed away in March of this year. Arzak was published in Metal Hurlant over 2 years. Arzak is a silent graphic novel. So it means there's no balloons for speech. Which contributes to create not only an image of science fiction, but also a world in which we could live. Moebius pays attention to every detail, vehicle, tools, and especially clothes. Moebius contributed to the visual aesthetics of many movies, including Alien, Tron, Les Maîtres du Temps, by René Laloux, Masters of the Universe, yes, it's that series with He-Man, and so he designed that, and The Fifth Element, and many more. In 1975, Christian Godard and Giulio Ribera created Le Vagabond des Limes, a series that borders the realms of dream and science fiction. Axel Mannheim dreams of a woman and tries to reach for her. But since venturing into the realm of dreams is illegal, Axel becomes a fugitive and has to flee from a whole galaxy of pursuers. Imagination knows no bound in this series, and there are some weird romantic triangles that are worth discovering. Of particular note, the first album of Le Vagabond was launched without being pre-published in magazines. This new trend would eventually spell the doom of magazines. In 1980, Enki Bilal begins his trilogy Nicopole with La Foire aux Immortels. The story features political comments, cruel gods from the past, robots, and all the science fiction gimmicks. Bilal, master of colors, gives haunting depictions of worlds in decline. So he's known like for his kind of gray tones. Everything seems decrepit and sad in his stories. Enki Bilal will later adapt his own series into a movie, transposing his grim vision to the screen. By the way, don't miss his movie at the RPL next Thursday night, November 1st, starting at 7, and there will be an introduction by Dr. Philip Mata. In 1983, Benoit Peters and Francis Coyton published Les Cités Obscures. This series is really particular because every story revolves around a unique architectural feature. In Les Murailles de Samaris, for example, the walls of the city move at night, reconfiguring the streets every morning. And in one other story also, there's one girl who walks sideways, and everybody else walks like upright, but eventually everybody will start moving sideways just as she does. Now just a quick note about science fiction bande dessinée in Quebec. Between 1981 and 2000, many short bande dessinée stories were published in the Quebecois magazine, science fiction magazine Solaris, that Dr. Reddick talked about, and here I have a few copies if you want to take a look. And the comics they feature are here, can easily be accessed with the little post-its. So they were published in Solaris, but although to my knowledge, none were later published in albums, so they are only available in Solaris. In 2008, Grégoire Bouchard publishes Vers les mondes lointains, a retrofiction set in province of Quebec of the 50s, so just after the Korean War, and a long time before Bill 101. So this creates a kind of very interesting world because, like, to have just one language is not an issue in this era. So it creates really kind of a dépaysement, so you feel like you're in a foreign country. However, the way the story integrates elements of French Canadian culture makes it a very interesting read. And I would like to conclude with some final remarks about French science fiction bande dessinée. When compared to North American and Japanese productions, what really sticks out in French science fiction bande dessinée are the worlds that are proposed to the imagination. Because of authors like Hergé, BD drawings became a very sophisticated art in France. French science fiction artists have been working on developing worlds, not only characters or vehicles. Their work have been influential in many cult SF movies, like Alien and maybe Star Wars, but it needs to be proven. Furthermore, many Belgian, Franco-Belgian authors went through fine art school or architectural schools. They were formed with the tradition of classic aestheticism in mind, which demand precision in drawing bodies and perspective. Backgrounds are given lots of importance, as much as would be expected, for example, in a figurative painting. On the subject of detail universe, I also remarked that French BD often exploit the theme of time traveling, which comes at no surprise since France's history is rich and ancient. Another important characteristic of French science fiction bande dessinée is that it can be and is often intended for adults. Erotism allows more liberty and more experiments than would be permitted in a story designed for children. Also, French science fiction BD often deals with politics. Politics will often be presented as a split between extremes like fascism, communism, and religion, which are often seen as the three extremes. But these systems propose social structures where there is little room for individual dreams. And the usual solution is to fight centralizing authorities and favor individual freedom. This results in an acute consciousness of social classes and strong anti-militarism. Thank you.
Our third and final speaker is Dr. Philippe Mather. He is an associate professor of media studies at Campion College, University of Regina. He has taught there since 1996. His doctoral dissertation is entitled Cognitive Estrangement Towards the Semiology of Science Fiction Film. His other areas of research include Orientalism and the cinema of Singapore, film music, and Stanley Kubrick. His most recent publication is called Stanley Kubrick at Look Magazine, Authorship and Genre in Photojournalism and Film, published by Intellect in 2012. Dr. Mather will discuss French science fiction and films. So please welcome Dr. Philippe Mather.
Thank you, Michael. So this introduction to French science fiction film is a brief historical survey of key films focusing on three related themes that appear to dominate the genre, time travel, fantasy, and sex. So we begin with our conference mascot, the Man in the Moon, who appeared in the very first science fiction film ever made, A Trip to the Moon, directed by Georges Méliès in 1902. So France was therefore a pioneer in science fiction film. And this particular work was a spoof of Jules Verne's famous novel, From the Earth to the Moon, itself an early entry into the literary genre. The fact that Méliès' film was a parody rather than a straight adaptation, I think, indicates that by the turn of the century, in many ways, in France, many no longer shared an unbridled faith in science and technology and the ideology of progress that underpins much science fiction. This results in a tendency to express science fiction themes through fantasy and humor rather than realistic drama. And in the 1925 film, Paris Asleep, also known as The Crazy Ray, directed by René Clair, A scientist develops a ray that puts the city of Paris to sleep, but has a limited range, as illustrated by the diagram on the left. So people on airplanes in higher altitudes or visiting the top of the Eiffel Tower are unaffected. And so this conceit allows for a morality tale in which the characters explore their newfound freedom in a frozen Paris, only to realize its relative meaninglessness. Now, the idea of a city frozen in time is quite evocative, and scenes from Paris asleep have been quite influential. If one considers the number of Hollywood films that have been made since that feature this theme, such as from The Day the Earth Stood Still to The Omega Man and Vanilla Sky. From frozen time, we move to time travel, and the famous short film Le Jeté, made in 1963 by the French filmmaker Chris Marker, who passed away in July, by the way, aged 91. It's perhaps best known for being the inspiration for the Terry Gilliam feature 12 Monkeys, and is a very effective film that draws its poignancy from the use of still photographs combined with impressionistic music and a time loop narrative that allows a character to escape imprisonment from a grim post-nuclear war environment. Once again, it features scientists experimenting on the hapless protagonist, sending him into the past in order to rescue the present, which of course introduces basic logical paradoxes in terms of causality. Yet it deals with a powerful fantasy, wanting to reclaim one's youth, correct mistakes from the past, and for the protagonist, at any rate, to reconnect with a lost love, who may very well be his mother. Love is a prominent theme in French science fiction, perhaps due to a Gallic penchant for matters of the heart and the loins, and perhaps because of its suggestive contrast with the cold, passionless logic of science. While much American science fiction can be described as action-oriented and sexless, the French seem to revel in opportunities to discuss their characters' love lives, which often involve celebrations of the female form. Barbarella, starring Jane Fonda, as Sylvain mentioned a moment ago, and directed by French husband Roger Vadim in 1968, is undoubtedly the most prominent example of this trend, one whose origin lies in the popular comic strip created in 1962 by Jean-Claude Forest. The story is set in an unspecified future as a lighthearted, erotic combination of Flash Gordon, Brigitte Bardot, and Lewis Carroll. Moving to animated film, one has to mention the much-admired feature film Fantastic Planet, directed by René Laloux, as Nick Ruddock mentioned, animated by Roland Tapa over a period of 5 years, and finally released in 1973. It was nominated for the Golden Palm at the Cannes Film Festival in that year and won a special award. So it's clearly not a space opera for children, but rather a surrealistic and political tale for adults. There is the influence of Salvador Dali. You can see a painting by Dali at the bottom here. We can see that influence in Topor's artwork, framed from the film at the top, as well as a deliberate effort to enhance the sense of estrangement by privileging description over narration and explanation. Thus, the language spoken in the film uses many unfamiliar alien terms that remain mostly mysterious. And the film concludes with a fairly supernatural or surrealistic scene involving aliens meditating in floating spheres that travel to another planet and land on headless statues, bringing them to life, apparently for procreation. A more recent film inspired by graphic novels, as Sylvain has mentioned, is Luc Besson's The Fifth Element, starring Bruce Willis and released in 1997. Unlike George Lucas, who never asked comic book artist Jean-Claude Mézières permission to use his visual concepts in Star Wars, Besson hired Mézières as a conceptual designer for The Fifth Element. Mézières then adapted his own work. In other words, he asked himself permission to use his own work, and it was accepted. specifically the 15th volume in the Valérian series, published in 1994, just before the production of the film, featuring a character who drives a flying taxicab through congested air traffic of a vast metropolis on a distant planet. So very much similar to Bruce Willis's character in the film. The film is mostly humorous and fanciful, except for the so-called fifth element, which is a mysterious transcendent power channeled by a pretty female alien who needs Bruce Willis's love in order to save humankind from destruction. Finally, the French graphic novelist Enki Bilal, who turned to filmmaking and directed the visually arresting film Immortal, Vitam, released in 2004, co-starring Charlotte Rampling. The story is set in New York in the year 2095. Earth is occupied by Egyptian gods and genetically altered humans. When a god is sentenced to death, he seeks a new human host and a woman to bear his child. So, more sex. A number of plot points involving political corruption and an evil eugenics corporation remain unclear in the film version, perhaps due to Bilal combining two of his own graphic novels for this adaptation. But the mystery adds to the film's aura, which is enhanced by the combination of live-action footage and computer-animated character. So I'd like to conclude simply by reiterating the idea that French science fiction films' apparent preference for fantasy over realism may be due to a cultural penchant for romanticism and surrealism over naturalism in a way that engages creatively or imaginatively with ideas about love and linear time that are not bound by empirical reality. And just a reminder that, as Sylvain mentioned, both this film, Immortal Ad Vitam, and La Jetée will be screened at the RPL Film Library next Thursday, November 1st. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank all three speakers today. It was very fascinating lectures, and I learned quite a bit, and I hope you did too. Again, there are books and comic books you can look at afterwards. Are there any questions? No? Well, I have one. Or no, go ahead, Chad.
It's just sort of genuinely maybe the one I'm looking for. I'm curious how much you, as scholars, feel the surrealism movement owes to that early heritage of science fiction. I mean, I sort of look at surrealism and think of fantasy and science fiction turned up to 11. Is there a fairly direct line that back to that, or is that just projected?
I mean, I can certainly speak to the film part. I mean, famous writers, Baudrillard, famously after the war, France was inundated with American popular culture and film and literature, and certainly the surrealist immediately took to science fiction as a genre that they could really, I mean, in effect, read against the brain and read through the particular lens, which was influenced by Freudian thought and so on, unraveling the unconscious and mythological basis. But I don't think there's a, it would be hard to call it a cause effect when actually it's more using something for purpose.
Well, from what I know of surrealism, they were the movement was kind of created by the end of the First World War, and it's in reaction to the First World War that the movement first dies, and after that surrealism were created, because the idea was like, especially realism, to destroy everything and start to become a because the structures that didn't exist at that moment were the structures that caused the war, caused destruction. And in order to create something new, some of the devices they used were like automatic writing, like inkjet automatic, and to create new images and to start fresh. And of course, when you want to create a new world, for example, in science fiction, you would probably use similar techniques to what the surrealism used. But I think in both cases, like the goal is a bit different. So where they come from and where they want to go, I can see how they could converge at some point. I think basically their goals and directions are very different.
To that, I would just simply add that, yeah, it seems to me that surrealism's chief goal was to make manifest the sort of the latent dream-like content of the unconscious, especially after the First World War. But just looking at, say, the image of the Georges Méliès film, right, the man in the moon with the capsule in his eye, that is a surreal image, without question. So I would say that surrealism has to be influenced by early films.
My question was about that image of the moon. Do we know whose face was on the moon? I've always wondered what that was. Don't know.
It wasn't George.
Okay, I thought it might have been, but I wasn't sure. Okay, well, thank you all for attending. There's snacks outside, and feel free to look at the books. And thank you again to all three speakers.
Oh, yeah.
I must come and see that showing of Immortelle.
Oh, yeah.
And Leisure Tea as well.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, if you haven't seen it recently, or
well, actually, I've been writing a chapter or two.